we made the deal. They came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel.
This hour, we look at President Trump's record so far as he wades into three military conflicts.
It's Tuesday, June 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, our co-host Juana Summers continues her conversation with Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska about her new memoir.
How we in Congress stand up for our delegated powers under the Constitution, that's what we need to be focused on.
Also, a lot of brides are discovering that tariffs are making those wedding dresses pricier now.
The last thing that I want to do as someone has fallen in love with themselves in a gown is to start talking about global trade policy.
And ancient Roman frescoes unearthed in the heart of London.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. A U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly is confirming that based on an early assessment, the massive U.S. air campaign against Iran this past weekend did not obliterate the country's nuclear program, as the Trump administration has claimed. Instead, he says it possibly set it back a few months. NPR's Tom Bowman reports it's just the latest indication of tensions between the White House and intelligence officials.
There is friction between the intelligence community and the White House. The White House, again, wants to say that they've completely been successful in ending Iran's nuclear program, but that appears not to be the case, according to this intelligence assessment. Now, analysts have long said that it's very difficult to completely end a country's nuclear program because you have the knowledge base there. In Iran's case, you still have some enriched uranium that they could increase to bomb-grade uranium.
Senators were slated to get a classified briefing today, but that's been postponed to later in the week. President Trump made waves before even arriving at the NATO summit in The Hague today. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte was working to have no controversies.
On the plane over, President Trump told reporters when it comes to NATO allies, he couldn't promise to commit to Article 5. That's NATO's core principle of mutual defense.
Depends on your definition. There's numerous definitions of Article 5.
Then Trump published a flattering private message he received from NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who told Trump he'd accomplished what no other American president had by getting Europeans to increase their defense budgets. Alexandra de Hoop Schaefer, head of the German Marshall Fund, said Rutte is just doing his job.
It's to balance U.S. and European strategic interests and priorities.
And, she says, to keep the U.S. engaged in European security and defense. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, The Hague.
Large parts of the eastern U.S. remain under extreme heat advisories, with temperatures in some locations pushing into the triple digits today. As NPR's Bill Chappell reports, it's the effect of a weather phenomenon known as a heat dome.
A heat dome occurs when a massive area of high pressure lingers. It traps warm air near the Earth's surface, and it tends to keep clouds and precipitation away. That's what's happening now. And with the jet stream rising from the West Coast into Canada before it reaches most of the eastern U.S., the heat dome can just sit in place, driving temperatures to record levels. The effect is like putting a lid on a pot of water so it boils more quickly. The phenomenon has put millions of Americans under heat alerts. Forecasters say a cold front should bring relief to the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic later this week, but parts of the Midwest will continue to suffer. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
Hopes a ceasefire between Israel and Iran will hold, sent stocks soaring today. The Dow was up more than 500 points. You're listening to NPR. Texas is hoping to lure more films and television shows to the state. On Sunday, Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill to boost subsidies for productions there. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco has more.
The bill increases the amount it offers movie and TV production in Texas, $150 million a year for the next decade. While that is not as generous as tax incentive programs in California, New York, and Georgia, Texas is offering cash grants. It's something that celebrities Matthew McConaughey, Dennis Quaid, Woody Harrelson, and others lobbied for online.
I'm talking about a whole new hub for film and television, a renaissance, a rebirth.
How about a wholesale takeover?
Yeah. Small fraction of Texas budget surplus could turn this state into the new Hollywood.
To qualify for the grants, at least 60% of the production must be done in the state, and more than half of the paid crew and cast members must be Texas residents. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
An Energy Star, a label used by the Environmental Protection Agency to denote energy-saving appliances, may be going away. The EPA hinting it plans to close the office, which would mean that stickers could be going away or become less reliable on appliances. In turn, that would make it more difficult for consumers to know if the appliances they buy are truly energy efficient and would save them money. Still, there are ways consumers can find that information online no matter what happens to the program. Crude oil futures prices fell sharply today, reaching a two-week low amid expectations a fragile ceasefire will hold, reducing the risk of a disruption in global supply. Oil fell more than $4 a barrel. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 4:06. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For those affected by Bemidji's storm damage, there is now a second location for tree debris drop-off. It's located in the field behind Target, open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Also, the City of Bemidji has released a list of verified tree service providers. You can find that list on the Bemidji Chamber of Commerce's Facebook page.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A fragile ceasefire between Israel and Iran appears to be holding, at least for now. President Trump is claiming credit and has billed himself as a peacemaker since re-entering office in January. Over the past 5 months, Trump has become directly involved in three separate conflicts, but so far, his record is mixed at best. To explain, we're joined now by NPR National Security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, I feel like so much has happened in even the last 24 hours. What is the current status on the Israel-Iran ceasefire?
Well, it's holding, though it really doesn't feel very solid or secure yet. Trump raged at both Israel and Iran this morning, saying they were both shooting after the deal took effect. And Trump, as we know, is a very strong supporter of Israel, so his sharp criticism was striking.
Israel, as soon as we made the deal, they came out and they dropped a load of bombs, the likes of which I've never seen before. The biggest load that we've seen. I'm not happy with Israel.
So most shooting over the past 12 days has been at night. It's now early Wednesday morning in both countries, so this will be the first big test of whether it's working. And Elsa, at this point, I feel compelled to quote Mark Twain, who said, "Giving up smoking is the easiest thing in the world. I know because I've done it thousands of times." Well, the same thing is true with Mideast ceasefires. Yeah. They're easy to declare. It's been done countless times. The hard part is making them stick, and that's precisely where we are right now.
That quote is so apt. Okay, but do we actually know how much damage has been done to Iran's nuclear program?
Well, at this point, we don't know for sure, and it's already shaping up to be a major point of contention. Trump said U.S. airstrikes totally obliterated the nuclear facilities. He angrily denounced the media today for questioning his position, but members of the national security community are offering assessments that are at least somewhat at odds with the president. One U.S. official, speaking on condition of anonymity, tells our NPR colleague Tom Bowman that the Defense Intelligence Agency believes the damage was limited at Iran's most important nuclear site, Fordo, and Iran's program has probably been set back a few months. Now, we should add that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dan Kane, said Sunday at a Pentagon news conference that the Iranian sites sustained extremely severe damage, but a full assessment was still ongoing.
Okay, so some competing claims in the U.S., but how do you think Israel and Iran are likely to characterize the war?
So Israel can say it greatly weakened Iran, its biggest rival in the region, and Iran can say it withstood a double-barrel attack from the U.S. and Israel and is still standing. So they could both claim some sort of success, though it's less than a full victory for Israel, and Iran has suffered another in a series of recent setbacks.
All right, let's turn to another war in the Middle East, Israel and Hamas in Gaza. What's the picture there right now?
Yeah, you know, this conflict has really been ignored the past couple of weeks, but more than 40 Palestinian civilians were killed in Israeli strikes today. That's according to Palestinian officials. The humanitarian crisis remains dire. And a reminder, Israel and Hamas had a ceasefire on January 19th, the day before Trump was inaugurated. He claimed credit for that truce, just as he's done in Iran, saying it wouldn't have happened without him. But the ceasefire collapsed with an Israeli offensive in March. Trump has not sought to restrain the Israelis in Gaza, and that war grinds on under conditions worse than the day he took office.
Mm-hmm. All right, to Europe. Now, the president has also tried to broker peace in the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. How is that effort going?
Yeah, Elsa, Trump just arrived in the Netherlands for a NATO summit where this war will feature prominently. Trump may meet Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky there. In short, the fighting has intensified recently, mostly because Russia has ramped up missile and drone strikes. And Trump runs hot and cold on this war, at times saying a ceasefire is near, then backing away and saying the two sides just might have to fight it out.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Elsa.
War broke out in the Middle East, but unlike in decades past, there has not been panic about a subsequent oil crisis. NPR's Camila Domonoske is here to explain why.
Immediately after Israel attacked Iran, crude prices did shoot up, but only by about 7% over a few hours.
We saw a lot of people kind of react to that, saying, why isn't crude reacting more? This is a real risk.
That's Rebecca Bobbin, a senior energy trader at CIBC Private Wealth. She says traders like her responded conservatively, in part because of recent experience with Ukraine, Gaza, other attacks.
Throughout all the other geopolitical events that have happened over the last several years, we get these spikes and then supply is not impacted and they revert very quickly.
And that's exactly what happened again. Prices were volatile, but the spike was short-lived. And that was partly because of the specifics of this conflict. Once again, supply wasn't impacted because oil wasn't targeted. It kept flowing. But there's also some global factors behind the quick recovery. Angie Gilday is U.S. energy lead for the accounting giant KPMG.
You know, we are in a period of time right now within the energy markets where we have a bit of an oversupply.
The world just has too much oil. Supply is growing faster than demand. We're making more than we need. Then there's a big overarching geopolitical transformation. The shale revolution in the United States has lessened the world's dependence on Mideast crude. Over a decade ago, new technology like fracking unlocked American oil fields. Jim Burkhard leads crude oil market research at S&P Global.
The U.S. is the biggest oil producer in the world by far. The impact on the oil market is profound.
The U.S. makes a lot of oil and could make even more. So the U.S. is less reliant on the Middle East, and the rest of the world has backup supplies if it needs them. But of course, right now the world doesn't need more oil. Quite the opposite. So while this week President Trump repeated his call to drill, baby, drill, Burkhard says,
we think, we've been saying for the last few months, we think U.S. oil production is going to decline.
Because the market is telling companies to drill less. To chill, baby, chill. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
How much extra would you pay to see your dream become reality? It's always a big question for couples planning their weddings. And these days, it has a new twist, courtesy of tariffs. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Helping a bride pick her wedding dress can be a pretty intimate process for the seller.
Helping them get in and out of gowns, talking about money, talking about emotions, talking about body image issues.
Christine Greenberg has been doing this for 11 years as a co-owner of Urban Set Bride, a boutique in Richmond, Virginia.
So the last thing that I want to do as someone has fallen in love with themselves in a gown and everyone is crying and we're having this moment is to start talking about politics and global trade policy.
But lately, tariffs have entered even the bridal fitting room, as couples are discovering that almost all the dresses are made abroad. Many are designed in the U.S. and made in China. The National Bridal Retailers Association says China accounts for a whopping 90% of the bridal gown market. One of those gowns, with a sweetheart neckline and a long tail, now belongs to a Boston bride, Jessica Kaplan.
When I showed up, they were like, we just want to let you know that due to the tariffs that are occurring, there is a surcharge on most wedding dresses that are coming in, anywhere between 10 to 15%. So we did have to pay a $150 surcharge on it. It wasn't detrimental, but it was definitely a bummer on the day a bit.
For a while, the Trump administration added a new tariff of 145% on Chinese imports. Now it's temporarily reduced to 30% until July 9. The two countries are negotiating, and American store owners have no idea how to budget this year.
By and large, wedding gowns are special order.
Claire Landgraf runs Finery Bridal Chic, a boutique in Rochester, Minnesota. She says when someone buys a dress from her store,
their gown doesn't come in for 6 to 8 months. So what's the landscape of tariff charging going to look like in 6 to 8 months? We don't know.
Many designers and stores have simply raised prices across the board to cover new tariff expenses. It's not just gowns coming from China, but also embellishments, trims, crystals, veils and hair pieces, hangers and garment bags. Landgraf, for now, is charging brides half her tariff cost per gown as a line item that she can remove if tariffs are gone when it arrives. All this has more brides hesitating to say yes to the dress.
This has been one of the slowest seasons.
In terms of people buying the gowns, she says since COVID, when parties were risky, brides are coming in, but they used to visit once or twice before buying, and now
I am seeing a lot more multiple visit brides.
Some of the most popular U.S. gown makers, Maggie Sotero, based in Utah, Allure, based in Tennessee, have urged the federal government to exempt formal wear from tariffs because American textile manufacturing faded out decades ago.
My dad was in the Army for 24 years. I would love to purchase American-made wedding gowns.
That's Virginia store owner Christine Greenberg again.
But they don't really exist. They certainly don't exist at the price point that the average American consumer could purchase a wedding gown.
An average bride, not in a big city, spends under $2,000 on a wedding gown. American-made dresses tend to start around twice that price. And not only are there few people buying them, there are very few people making them. Skilled technicians of lacework, embroidery, beading by hand. Growing this on a mass scale would take many years.
You know, I'm kind of curious about, what if I get like a dressmaker?
Chelsea Ritchie is another tariff season bride in Los Angeles who's trying to face the new reality by thinking outside the box.
You know, buy the materials and I buy the fabric and see if somebody can make me a dress within the same price versus me ordering it and then altering it.
Her dream dress is dazzling white with a mermaid silhouette. It's likely her fabric and materials would still be imported. Another decision to make, another thing to stress about during the joys of wedding planning. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phenology. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Board on Aging's Legal Kiosks, offering no-charge assistance with housing benefits, custody, and more. Legal kiosks located in libraries and local trusted community spaces connect Minnesotans with legal information and virtual meeting access. In some locations, court forms can be printed at no cost. Help is available in many languages. Online at legalkiosks.org.
On today's date, June 24th in the year 2003, I see my first evidence of spittle bugs. I say evidence because the bug is concealed by the spittle that is located on the plant. Spittle bugs, in their nymph stage, create these gobs of spit by sinking their mouth parts into the plant, inverting themselves so that their tail is up and their head is down, and as they suck the juices out of the plant, there are tiny hairs that are outside the body of the bug, and by wiggling a little bit, those hairs create a froth, spittle, that conceals the bug. If you come across one of these, simply blow the spittle away and you'll see a kind of a small, maybe eighth to quarter inch long green bug. This is the nymph stage of the spittle bug. And as it matures, it will go through several instars and ultimately it will emerge as a flying bug. And at that point, it's going to be quite triangular shaped, a bit like a leaf hopper, and quite adept at flying away and laying its eggs, which will then produce more spittle bugs.
NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Republican Lisa Murkowski wrote in her new memoir that she didn't desire a career in politics. And yet, the senator from Alaska has often found herself in the political spotlight. First, when her father controversially appointed her to fill his Senate seat when he became governor in 2002. Later, as an elected senator who gained a reputation for bucking her party and at times sharply criticizing the Trump administration on key issues.
I do not seek opportunities to poke a finger in President Trump's eye or anybody's eye. That's not who I am. That's not my style. But I am one who, when I see something that needs to be called out, I will call it out if it needs to be.
I sat down with Senator Murkowski yesterday in New York to discuss a range of issues that concern her, as well as her path to serving more than two decades in the Senate.
Something you talk about in great detail in your book is the number of times that you were on the opposite side of your party on key votes and went your own way. For example, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And it seems like you were in that position again with President Trump's sweeping domestic policy bill. What do you think that the American people should understand about what is currently in that bill and why you're not on board at this point?
Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on this because It is a bill that has come out of the Congress, not necessarily from the administration. So you're calling it his bill. He has clearly named it.
The Big Beautiful Bill, as he likes to say.
I don't refer to it as the Big Beautiful Bill. It is big, and I'm not quite sure it's beautiful yet. There is much in it, quite honestly, that I really like. I'm pleased with the increased funding that's in the reconciliation bill for Coast Guard. There are many aspects contained in the bill that I think are going to be important from a border perspective, from a defense perspective, and from an energy perspective. But having said that, where's the bulk of the attention right now? It's on Medicaid. So Medicaid is very important to so many in our state. None of our entitlement programs are entirely perfect. We can always do more when it comes to oversight and areas of reform. But I want to make sure that it works for those who are in greatest need. I still have some reservations about the SNAP provisions. This is the nutrition programs for needy families with work requirements that may not be attainable, not because people don't want to work, but because you come from an area in my state of Alaska. There are so many areas in rural Alaska where there are very, very, very few jobs.
And I'll ask you about just one other piece of legislation, which is the rescission package, which would take back $9.4 billion that were already appropriated for foreign aid, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'll just note that about $1 billion of that funding goes to CPB, which sends much of it to local stations that carry PBS and NPR programming. I know that you're on the Senate Appropriations Committee that's going to hold a hearing on this package this week. What's your view of this bill?
I am an unabashed supporter of public broadcasting. In my state that is so highly rural, It is the benefits of public broadcasting that allows people to not only get their news, but to communicate with one another, to be given alerts as to storms and what is happening with tides and landslides and the fishing report. So for me, I am looking at this and saying the threat to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is very real with this rescission, and it's not something that I support. Likewise, within some of the global health programs, we have seen the benefit. One of the ways that we are able to help in many ways avoid conflict is through humanitarian efforts that our nation is engaged in. And I think we need to make sure that everybody remembers that ultimately it is the Congress that has the power of the purse, has the power to determine those appropriations.
If I remember correctly, you have never voted for President Trump, is that right?
Correct.
And yet today, you're a member of a political party that has been largely defined by the president, his MAGA movement. I wonder, do you feel like there is still a place for moderates within the Republican Party, for people like you?
I think there is still a place in the Congress for moderates. We need more on the Republican side. We need more on the Democrat side. But you talk to most people in Alaska today, hopefully the majority in America today, they're going to say, why aren't they just solving some problems? Why does everything have to be so political? But that's kind of where we've been pushed. And the only way that we're going to be able to get away from that is if we push back.
Well, let me ask you this, because you make it clear in the book that you were quite concerned about the way that people see our institutions. What role should you and your fellow lawmakers play in restoring that credibility and integrity for people who don't feel like it's working for them?
Well, it's a great question, because we can't control everything, right? I'm one out of 100 people say, oh, you got a lot of stroke here. I can't necessarily fix the judiciary. I can't necessarily fix the executive, but I do have a place in the legislative branch. And so how we in Congress stand up for our own authorities, our delegated powers under the Constitution, under Article 1, that's what we need to be focused on. You can be a 100% Trump supporter and still stand up for Congress's authority. They are not mutually exclusive.
A broad question for you. Do you think that the country's democracy is on unstable footing?
You know, I mentioned I've been in the Senate now for two decades, long time. I've never been part of more conversations where people have asked whether or not, whether democracy is safe right now. It is not something that I would say, oh, you know, it's all over. Absolutely, positively not. But do we need to guard these fundamentals, guard these values with great jealousy and ensure that they survive? Absolutely. But it takes work.
I'll end on this note. Those people that you're talking about who may feel right now like it's time to check out, like they aren't engaged with the process for one reason or another, what is your message to people who right now feel like they don't have a political home?
Don't assume that anybody else is going to speak up for you. I've never been to a protest as a protester, right? What we saw weekend before last with marches around the country, where people were speaking up in some of the smallest villages in Alaska. I think that that's some of the best part of who we are. Do it peaceably. Do it without violence. But speak up.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, thank you so much for coming and spending some time with us.
Thank you.
Murkowski's new memoir, Far From Home, An Alaskan Senator Faces the Extreme Climate of Washington, D.C., is out now. And you can hear and watch more of this conversation at NPR.org.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national Native news coming up at 4:44. North Star stories produced by Ampers. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, welcoming Dr. Carlisle to their team, offering lid and cataract surgery, general eye exams, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com, let us help you see clearly. And we thank the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at LakeCountryJournal.com. Clear tonight, lows 50 to 55, slight chance of showers tomorrow in the afternoon, increasing clouds, highs 70 to 74. Looking ahead to Thursday, chance of showers, mostly cloudy, and highs in the mid to upper 60s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As the Trump administration looks to combine multiple fire agencies under one organization, firefighter numbers are dwindling. Northwest Public Broadcasting's Lauren Patterson reports on how the Nez Perce tribe is stepping up despite the challenges.
Three young firefighters are standing under the hot sun in Lapway, Idaho, doing an engine check on one of their fire trucks. All of them are tribal members and firefighters for the Nez Perce tribe. Riston Bullock is going into his 13th season. He says he does this job because he's dedicated to protecting the land and his community.
Now that I've been in fire for so long, it's kind of more being the first one to respond, put the fires out.
A big challenge here in Idaho and across the nation is that there aren't enough people to help.
We're losing firefighters. The numbers are going down.
People can still volunteer, but
we need people at the shop ready to go when those fires start.
Across from the shop in the air-conditioned office, Jeff Handel, the fire management officer, is on the phone trying to schedule repairs for fire trucks. He's also worried the younger generation doesn't seem too interested in firefighting.
It's pretty tough in today's world when you can get a job from work from home and do okay financially. Why would you want to go out and do the firefighting thing, which is very hard work?
Back at the shop, the firefighters are organizing equipment like ropes and hatchets. There could be changes coming to how the Nez Perce Tribal Fire Crew works with other agencies in the region. The Trump administration is trying to merge all federal firefighting into a single agency. That could mean shifting thousands of jobs around just as fire season is ramping up. Bullock says he's not sure how that would work.
I feel like it'll just kind of be a new name. But I still feel like we'll still have our shops and everything here will be mixed out through each other. And
approximately $1.2 billion will be requested as part of the new Wildland Fire Service budget. For now, Bullock and the rest of the crew aren't giving it too much thought. They're busy getting ready for the next call. Reporting in Lapway, Idaho, I'm Lauren Patterson.
The U.S. Senate is still drafting its version of President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill. Tucked away in that proposed budget is a measure to renew compensation for those who had been exposed to radiation from uranium mining and nuclear weapons testing. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
If finalized, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act would now sunset in 2028. It also expands eligibility for claims from the Trinity test site in New Mexico, where the first atomic bomb was detonated, and to more uranium miners. The Navajo Nation has been lobbying to reinstate RECA since it expired last June.
I'm in just so much pain all the time.
Maggie Billyman is Navajo. She has COPD and was recently diagnosed with liver and kidney disease. While downwinders like herself are hopeful about RECA returning, they're also concerned that lawmakers are considering huge cuts to health services.
This big, beautiful bill is just something else. You get help from the RECA compensation, right? And then take Medicaid and Medicare. It just doesn't make any sense.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Janie Hipp was recently named Chickasaw Nation Dynamic Woman of the Year by Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby. Hipp has dedicated her nearly four-decade career to food sovereignty through agricultural law, including her work at the USDA and the Native American Agriculture Fund. The award honors Chickasaw women who have made significant contributions to the Oklahoma tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. DT Track, your healthcare partner across Indian country, supports this show. DT Track provides culturally competent nationwide healthcare staffing to IHS, tribal, and urban health facilities. More at dt-track.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Total Wine and More, for discovering something new this summer, like a Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or tequila. Learn more at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Available to adults 21 or older. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Since the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear facilities over the weekend, one key question has been, did it work? Did the American attacks end Iran's nuclear program? President Trump insisted Saturday evening the attack was, quote, a spectacular military success.
Iran's key nuclear enrichment facilities have been completely and totally obliterated.
Well, now, according to a U.S. official not authorized to speak publicly, an early intelligence assessment says the damage was far less than the president claimed, and Iran's nuclear program was set back only a few months, with limited damage to centrifuges at Iran's Fordo facility. Virginia Senator Mark Warner is the leading Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, and he is here to tell us what he has seen. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Well, thank you, Ari.
You've read the intelligence assessment. What have you learned?
Well, I'm not going to talk about what I've seen in classified intelligence. I'm a little old-fashioned that way. But I have a whole lot of questions for this administration. I really am very disappointed they canceled the briefing that the senators deserved today. They've moved it to Thursday. But if you just look over the last 12 or 13 days, when Israel first launched the attack, the administration's position was, well, we would help defend Israel, as we should, but you know, we are not going to be involved. Then the American intelligence communities reiterated a week ago Monday that Iran had not made a decision to move towards a weapon. Administration went ahead and launched their attack, but they were saying at one point, you know, they were only going against the Iranian nuclear facilities. And no regime change, and the president said regime change, now he's back.
I hear you say the goalposts are moving, but I'm curious just what you know, how you would answer the question, was the attack successful?
I'm going to wait to hear the administration's explanation, but I have more questions than I had even before the initial assessment. And again, it's been in the public domain that there were large numbers of questions before any of this took place, whether these bunker buster bombs alone could take out the facilities. There's also very legitimate questions of whether the Iranians moved any of their enriched uranium out of those facilities.
Does the U.S. know where that enriched uranium is? The Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has about 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium, which, as you say, could have been easily moved.
It has been widely reported and non-classified that you could literally move that in about 10 carloads. I have not seen any indication that we know where all of that is at this moment in time. And let me be clear on it. You know, Iran should not have a nuclear weapon. This is a regime that has been against America, against Israel, been disruptive in the region. But there are reasons why previous presidents, including President Trump in his first term, didn't take these actions, because there are a lot of what next. I mean, are our troops fully safe at this point? Will there not be a third party or surrogates like Hezbollah or the Shia militias? Has Iran agreed not to attack us on a cyber basis? And again, as we've all said, it's a lot easier to start a conflict in the Middle East than it is to end one.
Political appointees in the Trump administration have tried before to pressure intelligence agencies to change their conclusions. We saw that with intel about the Venezuelan Tren de Aragua gang. How confident are you that the conclusions of the intelligence community on this, on the Iran attack, will be free of political interference?
I believe they are so far, and that's why I want to hear what they're going to say on Thursday. Again, I would remind you, the intelligence community said literally 8 days ago that Iran had not decided to move forward with the weaponization. It appears President Trump rejected that. Does that mean he's rejecting the conclusion? Is he accepting the intelligence from Israel? And what does that say if he's taking another country's intelligence over ours? And you're right, I am hugely concerned, as we saw where intelligence professionals were literally fired because they refused to bend the knee and alter intelligence. And we've seen this in the past. That's how we ended up in Iraq, 20-odd years ago.
Well, let me just ask in our last minute, if it is true, as this intelligence report apparently says, that these attacks only set back Iran's nuclear program a few months, where does that leave the U.S. effort to end Iran's pursuit of a nuclear weapon?
Those are the questions that need to be asked, and those were the questions that we wanted to ask, have answered before he took this action. What next if you don't take them out all in the first strike? What are the next steps? How do we make sure that there's not Iran racing now to a dirty bomb? These are questions that we, and frankly, the American people, deserve answers to.
That is Virginia Senator Mark Warner. He is the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ari.
In recent years, excavations in London have revealed incredible archaeological treasures from the Roman Empire, from remnants of roads to handwritten documents nearly 2,000 years old. Now, a dig in the heart of the British capital has unearthed one of the most extensive collections of painted Roman walls or frescoes that's ever been found in the city, as Willem Marx reports.
It was at least 1,800 years ago when colourful fragments from the walls of a high-status Roman building were discarded in a pit during an ancient series of demolitions. Now they've been unearthed at an archaeological site in Southwark, just south of London's River Thames. The person who oversaw their discovery, then the painstaking reconstruction process, is Han Lee, Senior Building Materials Specialist at the Museum of London Archaeology Charity.
There was actually two reactions which, will live with me for the rest of my life. I think the first one, when I realized the initial potential, and that was a feeling of excitement because I had thousands upon thousands of fragments to deal with. But then when you realize that there's actually good potential in good reconstruction, the excitement sort of overwhelms the dread, if you want to put it that way.
With material that filled more than 120 crates, it took months for Lee and his team to reorder the pieces of painted plaster into several massive frescoes, to assemble a jigsaw puzzle on a giant scale.
I remember it was sort of a late night at the office, and I just put in a really quite crucial piece. And then I looked up, and, there was this beautiful Roman large wall with a corner and a door included, looking right back at me. And it was a moment of silence where I looked at it. It was a beautiful moment to really take it in.
The reborn artworks included motifs of birds, fruit, flowers, and musical instruments known as lyres. But they also included writing with a nearly complete ancient Greek alphabet, the only time such an inscription has been found in Britain. Similar frescoes have been unearthed in modern-day France and Germany, but the artistic influences across the northern reaches of Rome's ancient empire remain little understood. Research into each plaster piece will continue, with plans for a future public display. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. And we thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. You can continually support KAXE by becoming a sustaining member. Choose a monthly payment amount starting at just $5 per month, then sit back and enjoy KAXE's programming, knowing that you are helping to make it all possible. You can set that up at kaxe.org. Thanks so much for your support.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's segment, a new warning from TSA about weapons in carry-ons. Then, farmers may soon be able to grow produce all winter long, and federal flood relief is heading our way. I'm Chantel Sings. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, confiscated two loaded handguns in just one day earlier this month at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. It's illegal to pack a weapon in your carry-on. Passengers who bring firearms to TSA checkpoints face federal penalties. Officials encourage passengers to pack smart and start with an empty bag. Passengers can travel with firearms in their checked baggage if it is unloaded, packed properly, and declared at the check-in counter. TSA officers have found 22 firearms at MSP checkpoints this year. Next, a new type of greenhouse will allow state farmers to extend the growing season, giving farmers the possibility of an income stream into the slow winter months. Britt Ahmet has the story.
Minnesota farmers may soon be able to raise and sell produce all winter long, thanks to the deep winter greenhouse.
So about 10 years ago, there were a couple farmers in southwestern Minnesota that wanted to grow crops in the winter, and they didn't want to use a lot of delivered heat.
Greg Swazer works with the University of Minnesota Extension.
So they cracked open their old books from the 70s and found a way to develop a greenhouse that captured solar heat, stored it in a thermal mass underground, and they use that to heat the growing space at night when the sun goes down, and they grew crops throughout the winter.
The new development came when those farmers partnered with the university to make a larger farm-scale version.
We're testing out this concept and seeing how well it works and whether it's something that farmers can use to economically and feasibly grow winter crops throughout the winter for sale to their customers.
Carrie Calvo is one of five farmers participating in the university's deep winter greenhouse study. Her Owl Bluff farm in southeastern Minnesota's Houston County got a grant to cover part of the greenhouse's cost, but she and her crew had to install it themselves.
So it's 60 feet long by 16 feet wide, and I want to say 10 feet high at the highest point.
There are key modifications that differentiate it from the high tunnel greenhouse you typically see dotting farms, basically metal ribs covered in plastic.
It's basically super insulated on all sides except for a steep glazing wall on the front that faces south. And it's set at the right angle to maximize solar gain during the coldest months of the year.
That allows it to store and retain heat even through long, cold nights, with little to no reliance on heaters, which could saddle farmers with an expensive electric or gas bill. Carrie plans to grow greens and herbs in her deep winter greenhouse.
Right now, we are hoping to do a winter CSA,
through which she could offer boxes of produce to subscribers every month throughout the winter. Normally, her income would stop at Christmas and pick up sometime around April. The greenhouse could prove to be an economic lifeline for farmers, says Greg Swazer.
We have a very strong local food movement in Minnesota. The problem is a lot of those farms don't make an awful lot of money, so any way we can find to make them a little more successful.
But that's not the only goal with the deep winter greenhouses.
There's been a number of things that have threatened our food supply. You know, COVID. If it gets too hot or the water dries up in the desert southwest, that's where the vast majority of our winter vegetable crops are grown. If we're unable to rely on that, this would be a good backup.
For North Star Stories, this is Britt Ahmed.
You're listening to North Star Stories. Parts of southern Minnesota are still recovering from the devastating floods last June that destroyed the Rapidan Dam. Crews repairing the damage now have an additional $5 million from the federal government to help. The funds will be used to repair and replace damaged and destroyed roads and bridges in Blue Earth County. With the County 9 bridge out, motorists and farmers are forced on a 15-mile detour. That road isn't expected to reopen for another 2 to 3 years. The state is also receiving federal funding to help repair roads in Minnesota's Chippewa and Superior National Forests in northern Minnesota.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 3 years ago today, the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, ending the constitutional right to abortion. Since then, about 40% of U.S. states have increased restrictions on abortions. And now, many women are having abortions without a doctor's oversight. And some doctors are okay with that. Here's reporter Abby Wendell.
For nearly 4 years, Maya Bass's commute included a monthly plane ride from Philadelphia to Oklahoma. Do you like flying?
Oh no, I get really motion sick. I'm really good at not vomiting though, so.
Bass made that trip each month to fill a gap. Oklahoma had a shortage of abortion providers, and she's a family medicine doctor who provides abortion. One way was by prescribing abortion pills. Bass was trained to follow a strict protocol around the pills. It included multiple in-person appointments to get an ultrasound and blood work, and to pick up the pills at the clinic. Bass believed many of these steps kept patients safe.
Of course I'm going to confirm exactly how big this pregnancy is. Of course I'm going to confirm that my patient has enough blood to handle this.
So Bass was concerned when she first heard about self-managed abortion, getting abortion pills without a prescription and taking them without a doctor's oversight.
Gosh, what if people are dropping like flies because they're taking meds that are actually rat poison and hurting themselves?
A lot of doctors had a similar reaction.
People felt it was really unsafe.
This is Jen Carlin, a professor of family and community medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. In the late 2010s, she became interested in the debate about self-managed abortion.
I wanted to talk with clinicians about this to find out, are you really worried about the safety of this? And if you are, what aspect of the safety are you worried about?
In 2019, Carlin turned these questions into a study. First, she surveyed 40 abortion providers and asked what they thought about self-managed medication abortions. About half of them were ambivalent. Then, Carlin gave them a fact sheet summarizing nearly 24 peer-reviewed studies that showed self-managing with pills is safe and effective.
Like, wait, what? Like, seriously? I never knew about any of this.
Bass was one of the doctors in Carlin's study. The research on that fact sheet showed that the protocol Bass used, the multiple appointments, the ultrasound, wasn't always needed.
Realizing that I was unnecessarily putting people through hoops, that's hard. And then I felt also excited slash maybe relieved. Like, this means that I can be less scared for people who are doing this.
The next year, 2020, far more doctors changed their minds because of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need for social distancing.
Now, all of a sudden, the healthcare profession is saying, wait, does that person really need to come in to do that ultrasound? And lo and behold, there's all this evidence already out there that no, they don't.
During the pandemic, the FDA stopped enforcing regulations on one of the abortion pills, mifepristone. Patients were no longer federally required to go to a clinic to get abortion pills. Doctors in many states began using telemedicine. Carlin went back to the doctors she had surveyed in 2019 to see what they thought about medication abortion with less medical oversight.
They're seeing it and they're saying, oh, everything I was reading about in those papers is right, and I'm seeing it from my own eyes, and now I'm even more convinced that it works.
Across the country, many doctors who provide abortions embraced a more demedicalized approach. As of 2024, 19% of all abortions happened with telehealth. But telehealth still requires a doctor to give a patient a prescription. Self-managed abortion goes a step further people get the pills on their own, often by ordering them online. More women have done just that since Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. Since then, studies have shown that the rate of self-managed abortion has increased, and so have online abortion pill orders. And organizations that support people through self-managed abortions have seen an explosion in people reaching out. That's true for the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, which is run by clinicians. Bass, the family medicine doctor, joined the hotline after reading the research about self-managed abortion.
The vast majority of the calls I'm dealing with are people just being like, hey, can you tell me if it worked?
Bass knows self-managed abortions can't replace all abortions. Some people need medical intervention or just prefer to go to a clinic. But to her, the hotline and the immediate access it gives women to doctors without unnecessary tests feels innovative.
It feels like I'm just on the cutting edge of medicine. I'm practicing evidence-based medicine that is the leading edge of what reproductive health care might look like.
The broader mainstream medical community has been moving in this direction too. In 2022, the World Health Organization declared self-managed abortion to be a safe and effective method in the first trimester. And in 2024, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists put out a statement in support of it. But there's been movement in the opposite direction, too. Last month, Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. ordered the FDA to review regulations on mifepristone, which could restore the rules that require patients to get multiple tests and pick up the pills at a clinic. If abortion pills get harder to access through the formal healthcare system, even more women may look to self-managed abortion.
That was Abby Wendell, reporter for Embedded, NPR's home for long-form documentaries. The podcast just came out with a new series about the history of self-managed abortions called The Network. It was produced with Futuro Media. One of the leading voices of early 1980s R&B, Kevin Yarbrough of the singing duo Yarbrough and Peoples, died this month at the age of 72. His wife confirmed to CBS News.
Yarbrough was a classically trained pianist who played and sang ferociously with his wife, Elisa Peoples. They were discovered by the Gap Band's Charlie Wilson.
Or Uncle Charlie Wilson, as some may know him. With his help, the duo signed to Total Experience Records, where they started making quintessential 80s music.
Like their number one hit, Don't Stop the Music.
Synthesizers, 808 drums, Elisa Peoples' bold yet endearing vocals. This was their recipe, which sounded futuristic then, but is now timeless.
And shaped so much of what the genre would sound like during the 80s.
The duo pioneered other hits like Don't Waste Your Time and Guilty.
I mean, when Don't Stop the Music came out, I mean, come on, we were skating off of that and just, I mean, it was just groundbreaking. And then the video, I mean, with the Muppets in there, I mean, it was so creative, you know.
That's Gina Sedman, founder and CEO of the entertainment magazine, the Indie Post Magazine. She interviewed Yarbrough and Peoples in 2023.
You know, she would talk and then he would complete her sentences, which is just like, I mean, it's like your normal everyday married couple that have been married for so many years.
The two were first introduced by a piano teacher during the early 1960s in Dallas, and they were married in the 1980s.
They were practically inseparable, playing, singing, and cooking together.
He loved his wife's cornbread. The way it was described, I mean, I can taste it, you know, from just the interview. She said she would take this chicken breast and she would bread it, and he used to love that. That was one of his favorite meals.
To Kevin Yarbrough, thank you for your major contributions to R&B music.
We still won't stop the music.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
www.ncbi.org.
It is a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. You can find lots of local information, including resources for those affected by storms in the Bemidji area, at our website, kaxe.org. Clear skies tonight, lows 50 to 55, and tomorrow, slight chance of showers in the afternoon, increasing clouds throughout the day, highs 70 to 74. Southeast winds 5 to 15, and lows tomorrow night, mid-50s. For Thursday, chance of showers.